Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, thanks everyone. It's a real delight to be here at Vandy, and thanks to James for all of the organizing and your team here with the Thomistic Institute. This is a topic, assisted suicide, also known as MAID, medical aid in dying, or medical assistance in dying, that I have been following for about 15 years. I give maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 lectures on it a year, kind of updating things as things move along. So it is, you might say, near and dear to my heart. What I would like to do is get you all engaged in the conversation. So this is going to be slightly Socratic. And what I want you to do is already be thinking, because I'm going to come back and ask you this, what are the strongest arguments in favor of legalization? And what are the strongest arguments opposed? Because there are very good arguments on both sides. And I think to discuss this issue meaningfully, we need to understand what both sides value as they push either for legalization or for not having it be legalized. Does that make sense? So I'm gonna circle back in a second. I'm just also wondering, I don't see a clock. Do you, James, you just let me know when I should maybe switch to Q&A? Okay, that's great. Yeah, or whatever. Yeah. Oh, the other thing I'll say is that I am really happy to be interrupted at any point. So if something comes to your mind and you just want the answer now, or if I can even offer an answer, just raise your hand. I'm happy to pause. Okay, here we go. So let me start with this. I want your brains cooking on the pros and cons, but what is the distinction between physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia? Yes, please. Good thought. Not precisely, no. Any other takers? Yeah, in the back.
One seems active and one seems
passive. I think that's getting at what your colleague was saying. Not quite. Although even within euthanasia, there can be active and passive euthanasia.
One's an outpatient prescription and one is an injection in a medical facility.
Yes. So the distinction is ingestion versus injection, right? So physician-assisted suicide most commonly, actually, here we go. This is what the American Medical Association, this is how the American Medical Association defines it. I know, how many medical or nursing students in the room or clinicians in the room? Okay, so we're like maybe 50, 60% clinical here. That's great. So this is what the AMA says. Physician-assisted suicide is doctor gives the tools, patient ends patient's own life. Okay? So the AMA would say, and they do say somewhere I've read long time ago, that even if a physician tells a patient how to end his or her life in some other way, plastic bag on the head, whatever morbid thing you want to think about, that is considered physician-assisted suicide if the patient goes ahead and does it. Okay. Increasingly, this language is changing. I'll get to that in a second. Euthanasia is when the doctor ends the patient's life. Usually the doctor places the IV, starts running the lethal substance into the patient's vein. Now this, to both of your points, could be voluntary or involuntary. What does involuntary mean? Well, it doesn't mean murder. According to the places where it's legalized, okay? So involuntary means that when a patient was able, had the cognitive capacity to make a decision about what happens later on when he or she loses capacity, they write an advance directive, they fill out a legal form that says, when my dementia is so bad, then I want to be euthanized. But when they get to the point where their dementia is so bad, they're no longer able to consent, right? So that becomes involuntary euthanasia, all right? And voluntary, of course, is what it sounds like. All right, so there's lots of terminology. When I started down this road 15 some years ago, it was really only physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. When Canada legalized, any Canadians in the room? Okay, we won't pick on you even if you are here. I always like to pick on the Canadians because when they legalized in 2016, they came up with this really brilliant acronym, Medical Assistance in Dying, you know, the little MAID. Who doesn't like a little bit of help, right? And so MAID became this acronym that has really caught on and has supplanted almost all other language. So yes, we still have physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, but MAID is really the leading term, whether it refers to, in Canada, medical assistance in dying, or whether more broadly it's used as medical aid in dying. Now, in Canada, both physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are legal. Which do you think Canadians prefer? Do they prefer to get the prescription, crush up those pills into an elixir and ingest it themselves, or do they prefer to have the doctor run the IV in? I'm seeing some head nods on the IV. What do we think? IV? Yeah. Yeah, actually, so in 2024, 16,499 Canadians elected MAID, and fewer than 5 wanted to self-ingest. Almost everybody wants to be put down, you might say. There's all these other terms, too, that are thrown around. Right to die, death with dignity are popular ones. More recently, I saw this word, dignicide, which is a very strange word. Yeah.
The statistic was for the year 2024 or from 2016 to 2020?
No, 2024. I'll show you a graph in a second. Okay, this, I don't love this. I asked Gemini this morning, actually, to make me a new graph. And so the blue states are the 14 jurisdictions where physician-assisted suicide is legalized. But I don't like the contrast with the red, so I asked Gemini to make me a graph, and guess what? Gemini does not know which U.S. states are which U.S. states. It was so fascinating. I tried to generate many different maps. And if these, anyway, this is parenthetical, but if these large language models are fed based on what we feed them, we Americans are really bad at our geography. And anyway, it was very funny. So this is the graph that comes, the map that comes from the nonprofit organization called Death with Dignity. They are big advocates of legalization of so-called physician-assisted suicide. And you can see blue is where it's legal. They say red is where legislation is pending, but this is actually not updated even for them, even though I got it this morning. So blue is where it's legal. You will note that New York State, for those of you who don't know where it is, it's that one. New York State, actually I might be able to use a pointer, legalized just on Friday, much to my dismay, so you'll pick up that I am opposed, but I'm happy to argue this either way, and I could actually argue it either way. Illinois also just legalized at the end of last year. Implementation will start September 12th of 2026. So 14 jurisdictions. There are 14 blue places here. That includes Washington, D.C., which you can't really see. Those are all of the places where it's legalized in the country. Now, physician-assisted suicide is the only thing legal in the United States. And that's actually been a very specific, you might say, technique of advocates, because if we brought into euthanasia, many, many, many more people elect it, as the Canadian experiment shows, and as I will also show you. So it has been a very deliberate technique to say only assisted suicide, you have to be able to self-ingest. We're not expanding beyond that. However, there are many jurisdictions in the world where it is legal. Now, when I first started on this, it was really only Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. And Luxembourg is kind of a blip of a country, so it wasn't that many people there. But it was Netherlands and Belgium, really, where you would see euthanasia. Colombia had legalized but in 2014, but Colombia, and you see these are the countries in the year of legalization. Colombia, interestingly, had two different laws on the books. So while euthanasia was legal, they had another law against the taking of life, which basically meant that they couldn't really legally proceed with euthanasia, though it was technically legal. It's only been in the last couple of years that euthanasias have moved ahead in Colombia. Canada is the big one, and I'm going to come back to Canada. Every place else, Australia is really growing in the number of patients who die by MAID. Everywhere else, it's, you know, Portugal, Uruguay is kind of still being worked out. And I'll just say, if you look at this map, so dark blue is where it's legal. This is a Wikipedia map. Light blue is where it is not legal. Red, interestingly, what is red? Well, red is places where they call it passive euthanasia. What is passive euthanasia? Withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment. So red is where it is illegal to remove a mechanical ventilator because that is seen as euthanasia. Are you tracking with me? Okay, all right. Okay, ooh, whoa, just jumped way ahead. All right, what are the pros and cons? Give me some pros, just throw some things out. Why would anyone want access to this, Micah?
Reduces the potential future suffering of a patient.
Yeah, who wants to suffer at the end of life? Who wants to suffer in general, but who wants to suffer at the end? Great. Yeah?
Respecting patient autonomy.
Respect patient autonomy.
Yeah.
Yes?
People don't want to burden their children.
Yeah, don't want to be a burden to your kids. Yep. Arguably a kind of suffering, but an adjacent kind of suffering.
It becomes a self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Especially yeah. If you don't believe in anything after death.
Yep. Or you don't believe that it's wrong to
right.
take your own life. Yes. Yeah.
Control.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a medical procedure, right? It's just a medical procedure. We control all kinds of things in medicine about the human body. Isn't this just another one? Any other reasons we'd want this? Burden on society.
They're telling us that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, now more the notion of giving through the organ donation.
Oh.
Between...
Oh, yes. It's another favorite of mine. Yeah, lots to say on organ donation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, why even euthanize them and then take the organs? Why don't we just euthanize them as we are removing the organs? The organs will be much better quality. Okay, that's pretty good. Nobody said cost savings. I hope not. We'll get there. Why would we be concerned? Why would anybody be concerned about legalization?
Who makes the decision?
Ah, who makes the decision?
How broad is that decision? I read that in Canada, depressed teenagers are now accessing it.
Yeah, actually, there's a really great story. I sent you the little video, James, of just very recently in the U.S., there's a young girl, I think she was maybe 23 or something, but young, who grew up in a very abusive household and just had a lot of trauma, a lot of trauma, got into sort of crystals and the occult and ended up wanting to kill herself. And she found a Death with Dignity organization that would kind of champion her. And they helped her figure out which clinician, and she basically submitted all this false information that she had a terminal diagnosis, all the stuff she just made up, had the prescriptions delivered, and she ended her life. They just made a very, very short documentary about her life because everybody says, well, in America, there are no abuses. And this is a very short documentary that shows that actually you can game the system if you want to end your life. Who makes the decision? In the back, yeah. Yes, yes, yeah. Yes, access ends up being, that access card is played a couple of different ways. There's concern that the vulnerable might be coerced into ending their lives. And so all of these safeguards are put into place. And then once the safeguards are passed and it's legalized, then those safeguards are seen as impediments to access. And so they're liberalized so that more people have access. So it's there's a tricky tension there. Good. Anything else that people are concerned about with regard to legalization? Hannah?
I think it like fundamentally changes like what medicine is. Like there's never gonna be an RCT on like what's the best way to kill oneself.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. I mean, is this what medicine is for? Mm-hmm. All of the clinicians in the room, I'll just say that when I went through all of my medical training and still, I never had a formal lecture on what medicine is for. Do you guys know what medicine is for? Because if medicine is only for wish fulfillment up to the limit of one's expertise, that's a very different kind of medicine than if medicine is oriented toward healing or restoration of health. And if that's what medicine is oriented toward, then you have to ask, well, what is excluded from that, and maybe you will still have physicians performing certain procedures that satisfy a patient's demands, but if those procedures aren't oriented towards health and healing and restoration, maybe that's outside of medicine. But yeah, that, I mean, I'd be curious, probably medical students haven't had that conversation. Yeah, James.
And I think just going off that, like you had made a very poignant point yesterday about like, where is your moral line?
Mm-hmm.
I think we all have a position where like medicine is becoming very transactional nowadays. And as physicians, we still need to kind of have a disposition to like, we can't just, everything the patient asks for, we can't just always like say, oh, well, I'm gonna do that for you. It's not like a customer exchange. There needs to be a point in time where you say, no, this, I don't agree with this, or I don't think that this is right to do.
This crosses a line, yeah. And so I think that's a question. I mean, that's a great thing to put on the table, James, which is that all of us who are practicing clinically are gonna have to decide where we stand on this issue, and then exercise our moral agency in accordance with that.
And I guess just more on like the pros and cons is what constitutes the line with MAID? Is it a fully conscious adult who wants to end their life, or do we expand this to people who may not have full capacity, or is it expand to children or not? Like, I think it opens up a lot of questions that may or may not want to be opened up.
Terrific.
I have two comments about that. One.
Go ahead, Father. Sorry, Wes. So, can you speak up just a bit?
Conscience protection for providers,
uh-huh.
Because when it becomes legal, then becomes a presumption that it's obligatory.
Right.
So
yes.
Connected to that, it expands this circle of issues where conscience protection becomes much more central.
Yeah.
And as a patient, like choosing your physician becomes like a big question. Like, do I need to ask, like, I see your CV and you went to school here and there, but what's your line on the value of life?
Mm-hmm.
And who?
Let me take two more comments. Why don't you go first and then we'll have Dr. Ely. So hastening a patient's death might not be harm if there is no moral opposition to suicide.
Yeah.
Okay, so you would make the argument that if the patient's dying anyway, they're gonna die. This is just, I'm just trying to understand your argument.
Yeah, I think it's more so that like, this could also be a way to do no harm. Like, when we think about like, what exactly is harm, like.
Right, are you just helping a patient relieve their suffering when they're dying anyway, or are you hastening death through suicide, right? Through assisting a suicide. And I think how you answer that question is gonna make a big difference on how you think about this issue. We're still on cons for a moment. Did you have any cons?
Yeah, first of all, I was gonna say that I think he who controls language controls society. And I think this whole MAID term is a euphemism. And I still call it PASNE, physician-assisted euthanasia, because I think MAID is too enticing,
yeah.
And it's covering up what's actually going on. So I don't like the term, and I'm not going to use it. But in here in this class, we can use it, but I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
Second, two more points real quick. One is that I think that the con is that it breaks the physician-patient covenant.
Mm.
And I think that I have a covenant with my patients, primum non nocere, first do no harm. And I interpret crossing the bright line of intentionally ending your life as harming you because it's creating your death. So I think that's the major con, is that I don't think physicians and people in the healthcare profession should be involved with this at all. If society chooses to do it outside of medicine, figure out how to do that, but I don't think doctors should be involved. And then
yeah.
The third point I was gonna make is that with regard to involuntary, you brought this up about, you know, maybe somebody's unconscious, they can't determine more. The involuntary euthanasia is also when the doctor does it without the patient's permission. You said that you define it as having the permission. In the Chambert paper in the New England Journal, 27% of all of the euthanasias in the Benelux countries was a doctor just determining, we need the bed, let's get them out of the way, let's inject them. But the patient never gave any permission whatsoever to do it. So
yeah,
the voluntary can be much more sinister than I used to give permission and I'm unconscious now.
Yes, and so that is technically illegal though.
That's considered murder. That's
it's,
why
yes.
Involuntary euthanasia
it's, it shocked me that that paper reported involuntary euthanasias that way because they basically were acknowledging that they're murdering.
And I called the author
yes.
and said, are you kidding me? What, tell me exactly what you meant. He goes, no. These were people who never, ever gave any permission.
And we just offed them.
We just did it. And
yep.
I talked to some of the doctors who did it, and they said, yeah, we do that.
Yep, yeah. No, I know that that is true. That is illegal. And so in the realm of what this legally represents, yes, that's what involuntary euthanasia is, advanced directive, now I can't consent. But you're exactly right that this has happened since the beginning, since doctors have had the tools to end patients' lives. And it's much less common than overt euthanasia through the medically approved legalized means, but it does happen and it's always happened. Yeah, you're right. Thank you for putting that on the table. I need to keep moving. Sorry.
Can I just ask a clarification?
Uh-huh.
When you say made, is that assisted suicide or euthanasia?
So in Canada, it's both. In Canada, it's both. In most jurisdictions, it's both. In America, it's only physician-assisted suicide. In Switzerland, it's only assisted suicide. And I say assisted and not physician-assisted because in America, it shouldn't be physician-assisted anymore either because in some jurisdictions, NPs, nurse practitioners and physician's assistants can also write the lethal prescriptions. In Switzerland, it is not a physician who actually provides the lethal prescription. But there's a very well-worked-out law in Switzerland. So most of the time when people say made, they refer to one or the other. In the US, it's only assisted suicide. I'm going to just keep moving, okay? Okay. I know, thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, so I think you guys named 1 and 2 relief of suffering and honoring autonomous choice, and everybody always does because those are the biggest arguments in favor. So if you go to hearings where state legislatures are debating whether they should legalize, advocates of physician-assisted suicide always bring in these terrible suffering patients who tell their stories, and everybody's like gripped. Like, of course they shouldn't have to live like that, right? Of course they should be allowed to die is the language. And so relief of suffering really pulls on the heartstrings. I had a friend say to me once, very recently, he said, you know, it makes me so mad that physician-assisted suicide is not legalized in Massachusetts. My friend really wanted access to it, and she died before she got it. And I'm thinking, like, can we even think about what's going on there with that language? Like, she died a natural death and didn't have to poison herself to death. Okay. And then honoring autonomous choice. Oh, the slides didn't quite translate well. Okay, so this is Oregon data. Oregon was the first state in the U.S. to legalize. They legalized in 94, started physician-assisted suicide in 97, started recording in 1998. If you go to Oregon State website and just search Death with Dignity Report, you can get their annual reports every year. So if you just look at this, the column on the very right, total, is all people in Oregon since 1998 who have elected physician-assisted suicide. And then on the very left, you see what are their end-of-life concerns. Number one, 90% say they're worried about losing autonomy. Number two, 89.4% say they are less able to engage in activities making life enjoyable. Right? That's a kind of suffering. Going further down, we see burden on family, as was mentioned here in the room. Only 46% are worried about being a burden. And in terms of pain control, less than 30% is actually worried about pain. So pain is not the big one. When push comes to shove and people are seeking these lethal prescriptions, it's not really about pain. These keep jumping. So interestingly, Compassion and Choices is the leading advocacy group for legalization. Now, Compassion and Choices encapsulates, in the name of their organization, the idea of relief of suffering and respect for autonomy. It's very, very clever marketing. Who doesn't want care and choice at the end of life? Additionally, that's very clever about them is they work very closely with dying people who want access to physician-assisted suicide. And these dying people, when they die, bequeath their estates to Compassion and Choices. So it's a very well-funded organization. The final thing I'll say about them is Does anybody know what they're a rebrand of? They used to have a different name.
The Hemlock Society.
The Hemlock Society. Right. So what does hemlock mean? Socrates died by suicide by ingesting the hemlock. So you could think of the former name of Compassion and Choices, very clever rebrand, as the Suicide Society. But obviously, if you're trying to distance a medical procedure from the act of suicide, you need to change the name, and that's what they did. Okay, so then you guys all learn, and I'm just gonna say as a medical ethicist, I really hope that you learn that there are more principles in ethics than four. But this is what every medical student, and I think nursing student, is taught. There are four principles of medical ethics: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. This comes from the textbook that everybody quotes, but really, there are many more principles that guide our ethical decision making. I'm just gonna say that. But what do you see here when we're thinking about legalizing assisted suicide? Autonomy and beneficence, relief of suffering. It's right there in two of the four principles. This is when Roger Katz, interestingly, is a Republican. Sometimes we think of these issues as being like the conservatives are the life people and the Democrats, the liberals are the choice people. But actually, this is a really interesting issue because many libertarians would fall under the Republican umbrella and also tend to be big advocates of access to physician-assisted suicide. Republican Senator Roger Katz in Maine really pushed for legalization, and of course it's legal now in Maine, and his whole argument was self-determination. And then of course you all have heard this: I will use treatment to help the sick according to my ability and judgment, but never with a view to injury and wrongdoing. Again, this gets to the comment in the back: is it injury and wrongdoing to provide a lethal prescription, or is that helping the sick according to my ability and judgment? And so one's answer to that question would make you either inclined to give a lethal script or not inclined to do that. Okay, yeah.
So relief of suffering. My understanding is that the way MAIDS works is that the person is paralyzed and that they die by drowning slowly.
No, not quite. But so the cocktails have changed over time.
Are they suffering and they look dignified and peaceful?
Yeah. No, it is true that one of so the cocktails have changed over time. There's been no randomized controlled trial. The main cocktail that's used now does provide a paralytic. It does provide an antiemetic to keep you from vomiting because it's really easy to vomit these things up. And it provides a whopping dose of barbiturates to suppress respiration. And there are a couple other drugs in there I can't think of off the top. Those are the main ones that control it. I wouldn't say drowning. I think drowning is probably an overstatement. I think the goal is respiratory suppression.
So the person is potentially suffering terribly and can't express that because they're paralyzed.
As I said, it's a very safe procedure.
Yeah. There's no RCT and no...
Very effective.
Yeah. Whopping dose of pain meds to hopefully are suppressing consciousness so that the patient's not really aware of what's going on. Yeah, complicated. Yeah, no randomized controlled trials on this. Okay, so safety. Safety, and I think of safety as an idea of medicalizing a procedure, kind of giving it an official status because, hey, it's the doctor who's encouraging you to do it. And don't we trust doctors in society? Not really, but arguably we're supposed to trust doctors. They have our best interests in mind. This is a photograph from the New York Times from several years ago when a husband-wife couple got into deep financial difficulties, and early in the morning while their children were still asleep in bed, they went to the top of their building and jumped. And this is the picture and of the scene below where they landed. Judge Richard Posner has been a big advocate of legalizing physician-assisted suicide. He recently retired, but he's a very famous judge from the 7th District Court in Chicago. And his line was like, look, lots of people want to die by suicide. And he says, but they don't, because there's all kinds of stigma attached, like who's gonna take care of the corpse afterwards? And that's why I give you this photograph. Like, it's kind of embarrassing, but lots of people want to die by suicide. And he says, then he's got this whole long piece on it, but he says, the costs of suicide all disappear if the physician becomes the agent of death. Because if killing a person who wants to die is a lawful form of medical treatment, which is what we're pushing with the safety argument, this is a lawful form of medical treatment, this signals that suicide is proper. My doctor told me to do it. It must be okay, right? And so Posner is advocating for legalizing, but his language is so fascinating to just raise concerns. How many people do want to die? And I'm hopefully going to get to this, but I'm going to just foreshadow that there's a bioethicist at the University of Oxford who has been studying the effect, we don't know if it's an effect, the rise of conventional suicide in jurisdictions where physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia are legalized. And what he has found is that in every jurisdiction where it's legalized, the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, Belgium, Netherlands, in every jurisdiction where deaths by MAID go up, there is a concomitant increase in conventional suicide deaths. Now, why would you kill yourself with a, you know, a gun from Walmart if you can just go to your doctor? I think part of the answer is that once the taking of human life is normalized, it's hard to stop. So there's all kinds of taking of human life. If we have time, we'll get to his stuff. Okay, so what does it mean for this to be safe? Well, you have to have capacity. I would say these are generalized from all 14 jurisdictions where this is legal, okay? You have to have capacity, you have to be fully informed, not coerced, able to take the medication without help. That's an interesting one because, we have so much to cover. That's an interesting one because if you have advanced ALS and can't use your arms, how can you take those pills and form the elixir and self-ingest? So several times in the United States, there have been legislation put forward to try to expand access so that you can appoint your euthanizer. If Alexis has ALS, God forbid, and can't take her pills, she can appoint her husband to administer this lethal prescription. Which is, you're choosing your euthanizer. That has not passed so far, but you can see how what once was considered a safeguard now becomes an impediment to access. You're supposed to be somewhat terminal with 6 months or less to live, be able to rescind the request, and your will, et cetera, is not supposed to be at stake. Lots of other safeguards vary in terms of waiting periods. Some jurisdictions have done away with waiting periods altogether. Do you have to be a resident of the state, not in Vermont or Oregon? So they've done away with state residency requirements. Interestingly, it was one thing that our governor in New York insisted on, that you have to be a New York state resident to have access. And then I already mentioned expanding to NPs and PAs. So we think we have all of these safeguards, but yet there's no control over the lethal prescription once it's dispensed. So here's a little story from Australia where there were an assisted suicide kit. The person for whom it was intended went out for a walk, and while she was gone, her father killed himself. So cost is interesting, right? We know that the most expensive year of life for healthcare is that last year of life. Dying people exhaust healthcare dollars. It's just true. So there'd be one way to solve our blooming healthcare cost crisis by not having people live that last year of life. And in fact, for those of you who are interested in this, Louise Perry, who's a UK journalist, has an amazing piece in the New York Times. Where she quotes all of these government officials who are talking about how they can save money for healthcare budgets if they legalize MAID. It's a very good piece, Louise Perry, New York Times. Cost is tricky because it can also be coercive, but it can also be good for budgets. And this is just a piece by Zeke Emanuel from a long time ago when the US first legalized. They were trying to figure out how much the US would save. Canada did a similar study. Canada, initially when they legalized, they were reporting projective savings, and they thought if they expanded initially, they could maybe save $149 million a year. Obviously, reporting this kind of stuff is not favorable because people start to feel like the government just wants to get rid of them. So Canada is not reporting this information anymore. But you can see the impetus to try to save money on the one hand, which is good. On the other hand, the coercion. So this is a sad story of a mother who didn't have access to her very costly intravenous drug that would keep her autoimmune disease in check, but she could end her life for $1.20. Similarly, this is a gentleman in Canada with a neurodegenerative disease. And for those of you like me who've taken care of many patients with disabilities, you know these patients come to the hospital, their families are exhausted, they always feel like they're trying to make a case for why you should keep treating my loved one, and it's impossible to persuade young, healthy doctors that my child with severe disabilities has a life worth living. So this guy was in the hospital in Canada. The doctors keep telling him he should consider MAID, and so finally he recorded it and sent it to the media and went all over the media that he was being pressured into ending his life. Okay, cons. We'll just start with rapid expansion, slippery slope. This is what's happened in Oregon. Purple are prescriptions requested. Green is people who have actually ended their lives. And what I just want you to realize is that the graph keeps going up. And the population of Oregon is not increasing at this rate, okay? So this is an increase in deaths by assisted suicide, or what Oregon calls death with dignity, that is exponential compared to population growth. This is Canada. So somebody asked me about Canada. You see, 2016, when they legalized, it was about 1,000 people. By 2023, 15,343. 2024, the last year for which we have data, they stopped making this graph, unfortunately, 16,499. Now, you see that red part of the graph. Canada legalized in 2016, and by 2017, the first jurisdiction said, why should you actually have to be dying to have access to MAID? Why can't you just have irredeemable suffering as defined by you, and then you can have access to MAID? So the first jurisdiction said death does not need to be reasonably foreseeable in 2017. By 2021, everywhere in Canada, you don't have to be dying to get MAID. You just have to be suffering as defined by you in a way that is just too much for you. And so what do we see in Canada? So that's the red section. Those are people who aren't actually dying. What do we see in Canada? We see that people who can't pay their rent are seeking MAID. People who can't afford their drugs are seeking MAID, their medications. There is a Paralympian and veteran who requested a wheelchair ramp for her building. And the Veteran Affairs Bureau said, we will not provide that, but we will provide MAID. She obviously went to the media. They did an internal review, et cetera. Solve the problem. But you can see how this becomes a real problem. And I know we're getting short on time, but I will just also do a little shout out that in 2024, I think the number is more than 3,400 people in Canada, 3,400 people in Canada sought MAID. One of the reasons they gave was loneliness. Maybe not the only reason, but certainly one of the reasons. I have the number later on. Did you? Canada has not yet legalized for mental illness.
And she just doesn't want to seek it for the other ways.
So I'm going to keep moving just because of time, and I want to, we're supposed to be on Q&A, and I haven't even, let me keep going. Yes, so there's some people, okay, so let's just talk about this slide, because slippery slope ends up being an issue. Belgium legalized in 2002, and there were all these stipulations that were really controlling to try to keep it very safe, and they very quickly liberalized. So the top photograph here is a woman in Belgium who suffered from depression for years. Her own psychiatrist said she didn't qualify. There was more they could do. She had just broken up with a boyfriend. She'd gotten into a fight with her son and her grandkids, so they were temporarily estranged. She went to her psychiatrist and said, I want to die. He said, no, like, I'm not doing this, because this is a momentary thing. You broke up with your boyfriend. You're in a fight with your son. She found another psychiatrist who would euthanize her. And 2 days later, her son gets a letter in the mail. Your mother's dead. And this was all written up in The New Yorker, which is how I first met her son, was through The New Yorker article. And then we worked on stuff together for a while. Belgium also, you can just be elderly, tired of life. The two guys in the middle picture are twin brothers who were born deaf. Their ophthalmologist said, you're at high risk of going blind. And they said, oh, rather than face a future of deafness and blindness, why don't we just get euthanized together? So they did. Gentleman in the bottom is Nathan Verhelst, born Nancy Verhelst, underwent what we used to call sex reassignment surgery. This was a little while ago. Gender-affirming surgery, did not like the way the surgery went and elected euthanasia and qualified for that. Alzheimer's patients, children, foreigners, you don't have to be a resident of Belgium. The mentally ill, all possible in Belgium, but mental illness, not in all jurisdictions. Netherlands, this is Netherlands. Netherlands said, there are all these cases that we don't think people qualify. Let's create a special right to die society that became known as the Euthanasia Expert Center. And they now review the most difficult cases, usually patients who don't have capacity, have memory loss, dementia, or psychiatric illnesses. And then they decide whether they should send a team out to the patient's house to euthanize the patient. They have a team of 150 doctors and nurses who do this. This is from their website. It's a Google Translate of it. But basically, they say here that one of the reasons to get made is the so-called accumulation of age-related disorders, visual impairments, hearing complaints, motor problems, incontinence complaints. I work on the internal medicine wards. This is like every patient, yeah. Right? But this accumulation of age-related disorders now is an indication in Netherlands for euthanasia. This I just want to point out to you. So do you all know that the population of Canada in that great big country is the same as California? It's only 40 million people in both places. And interestingly, both places legalized at the same time. California legalized assisted suicide. Canada legalized MAID, largely euthanasia. But look at the difference in numbers. And this is why I think if we are pushing for legal, if we're pushing for legalization in this country, we want to keep it as assisted suicide, because once it becomes lethal injection, everybody's ready to roll up their sleeve and have the doctor do it. Far fewer people are likely to take the pills themselves. So euthanasia is definitely more potent. It's not just pain. We talked about this. We talked about how waiting periods have gone away. Nurses and PAs can do it. You don't need to be a resident in some jurisdictions. Okay, here's another concern, is this idea of copycat suicide. I already alluded to this gentleman's work from Oxford. There's lots of different ways to think about copycat suicide. This is kind of an interesting one because it's from the medical literature for the medical people. Anybody see that Netflix show 13 Reasons Why? Yeah. So it culminates in a suicide. Right? You guys remember? Did you watch the? Yeah, okay. So 13 Reasons Why was this Netflix show. I never watch it. It culminates in a suicide. And this is a JAMA Internal Medicine article. And what they did is they looked at searches for how do I kill myself that started right after that final episode when the girl kills herself and it goes until another high-profile suicide. And they found a 30% increase in searches for how to take one's own life in the period immediately following this high-profile suicide on television. And what we know from this idea of copycat suicide is that this is a really jumpy computer system, but people who, so David Phillips was the guy who originally documented this. After Marilyn Monroe died by suicide, there was a whole rash of suicides by women, her same demographic, same age, maybe same kind of situations. We see that when there's a high-profile suicide, there's a whole rash of suicides from someone who's in a similar demographic. That's this idea of copycat suicide. It's a phenomenon we've known about going back to the 1700s. It's also why, for the students in the room, when a student at a university dies by suicide, the university might make an announcement that there was a death of a student, but they almost never, they shouldn't, describe the details of what happened, because there's concern that it will put the idea in other students' minds. All right. Final thing. Woof. Sky is. Oh, look. Wow. I'm just going to let it. Yeah, it's very. It's very tender, you might say. Okay, potential for abuse. And I'm going to wrap up in 2 minutes, and that'll leave us with a couple minutes for Q&A. So numbers shot way up in Belgium in a six-year period. The Belgian folks who do euthanasia have stopped reporting this. But in this six-year period from 2007 to 2013, the number of little old ladies in nursing homes with no education doubled to tripled in a six-year period. They no longer report that. The problem, these guys who are in favor, bioethicists in New York City who are in favor of legalization, they say the problem with the slippery slope, interestingly, even though they're in favor of legalization, is that you never know when you are on it. At what point do we be uncomfortable, do we become uncomfortable with the number of people who are dying by euthanasia? Is it okay if it's 1 in 20? Is it problematic if it's 1 in 5? At what point are too many people dying this way? This was the front page of the Washington Post when Washington, D.C. was thinking of legalizing. It's really aimed at old black people. And for those of you who know about the makeup of Washington, D.C., the majority of its residents are African American. And last time I checked, I think there was only one, maybe none. I don't remember. It was like almost none who identified as African American who elected physician-assisted suicide. Concern that this is, this is targeting people has been a real concern. Of course, we have that same concern for folks living with disabilities, and I think this is very provocative, right? We make it so easy to end life. We make it much harder to meet the needs of folks with disabilities. Woo, okay, wow. I promise I only pressed it once.
I think it's a keyboard.
Okay, we're landing the plane here.
Can you use the clicker?
Oh, maybe this is better.
So click on the bottom, just bottom left. There you go.
Oh, look at that, this whole time, come on. All right, so let me just say this. This is data from Canada. In 2024, 432 people were euthanized who needed disability services but did not get them. So it was listed as one of the reasons. I like this. This woman, when Canada legalized, she's 82. She went out and got a tattoo that says, "Don't euthanize me." I don't think it counts as an advance directive, but. Potential for abuse. This is this 3,399 people euthanized for loneliness in Canada in 2024. And then I'll just stop here, but this is a case from the Netherlands. An involuntary euthanasia where the woman had said, "When I know my memory's going, when I'm past the pale, it's okay to euthanize me." She's in a memory unit. She's creating trouble for staff. She's wandering. She's trying to sneak out. And the staff pull her advance directive and they say, lo and behold, she's given permission to euthanize her when her memory is so bad. They call up the family. They say, her memory's so bad. I think she wants to be euthanized. Family says, yeah, that's her wish. Let's we'll honor her wish. So this patient really loved coffee, so they put a sedative in her coffee and she had a paradoxical reaction to it and became really hyper. So they couldn't get the IV in her arm, so they gave her a different sedative, asked the family to hold her down. They put an IV in her arm and she starts screaming, don't kill me, don't kill me. And the doctor went ahead and injected her, and she died. The nurses, this is why I'm bringing this up. This is the Netherlands. They legalized in 2002. They do this all the time. But the nurses were so distressed that they proceeded with the euthanasia while the patient, though not in her right mind, is yelling, don't kill me, don't kill me, that they filed suit against the doctor, the nurses. And so this goes to the courts for several years. And finally, the judge rules that the doctor did not intend to violate the patient's wishes, and so it was no fault. But the judge said, next time a patient is screaming, don't kill me, when you're attempting to euthanize them, please do not follow through with the euthanasia. There you have it, folks. We have a few minutes for questions. Yeah.
Can you argue for the ethics of this? obviously, like, proponent for it is, like, oh, people are suffering. Like, how do you argue for the idea that a suffering life isn't necessarily a life not worth living, even for a period of time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky conversation to have, and a longer one than maybe we have time for. But I practice in a super secular context, right? So, like, bringing in theological language around suffering is you can't start there. It is true, and I will say to people, I often draw on patient experiences. I've cared for so many patients who have had really, really unbelievably difficult circumstances. They've suffered a lot, and actually, patients who have kind of engaged in the process through that with their communities and been thoughtful and reflective on it will say later, not in the moment, but they will say later that they learned and grew through that experience. That's possible. And so I put that out there for patients just to let them know that it might not all be in vain, that maybe when I get to the other side of this horrible thing I'm going through, I will see it differently. And then there's all kinds of data. So, you know, you guys know the studies, like you ask a room full of medical students, would you want to live as a paraplegic, quadriplegic? And they all say no. And then you ask a room full of quadriplegics, are you happy to be alive? And more than half rate their life as good or excellent. Because coming through the tragedy, the trauma, they've learned a different way of being in the world, and they're thankful to be alive. It's not what they anticipated. So just kind of giving examples like that is a way that I try to put that conversation on the table. Thank you for that. Father.
One of the concerns I have when I was in the hospital chaplain is, so almost all emergency rooms, they have a protocol for suicide.
Yeah.
Which, in other words, it is by definition contrary to patients' wishes.
Mm-hmm.
The big concern for me as the slope continues to expand, as the slope expands, at what point does even a typical, to use that term, assisted, attempted suicide becomes an expression of, a voluntary act that's used now that would change an entire protocol, whether
yeah.
a religious, a faith-based institution or a secular institution, because as the restrictions are relaxed, I think we lose all distinction between, and I think this is where you slip in, a presumption on behalf of the dignity of life and non-life that there is something else motivating this particular act that a protocol, protocol that contravenes that particular expression of the patient.
Right. So I think that's why the strategy for advocates is distinguish the two. There's a medical procedure, and then there's conventional suicide. They're not, the strategy is to keep them completely separate, which is why Dr. Ely is really trying to stay with the language of physician-assisted suicide to say, no, this is the taking of life. This is the taking of one's own life, which has always been defined as suicide, right? So if you can separate those cleanly, it's never clean, and that's your point, then you have people who don't have a terminal diagnosis, who are ending their lives not through a doctor-prescribed means, and then you have doctor as gatekeeper of suicide. And if doctor is gatekeeper of suicide, it's always fine. I didn't tell you this, but the group of people who's most likely to elect physician-assisted suicide in the U.S. are people average age of 72, median age of 72, majority with advanced cancer diagnoses. After that, it's like advanced COPD, advanced heart failure. So very sick people often, or with bad conditions, those demographics, advanced cancer in your 70s, is a very, very high risk group for major depressive disorder. What percentage of people do you think seeking lethal prescriptions are actually screened for depression? 20%? Yeah, last year Oregon screened 3 people. So to your point, we're not asking. We're not asking. So then it's really legitimate suicide is if the doctor writes the prescription. We don't know if you're depressed or not. We don't know if it's treatable or not. Illegitimate suicide is if you do it yourself. Yeah. But it does make the doctor the determiner of whose life is worth living and whose life isn't. Yeah, please.
I'm just going to ask. Some not come at this with a secular context, but you're saying if you're making the argument to the public, how do you reconcile that with like American independence or individualism? Like the society that said it was named after Socrates, I believe Socrates, he could have fled to some other town, but said like, no, I'm gonna stand on my beliefs and not change them and commit suicide. Mm-hmm. So how do you, in a specifically American context, say, you can't decide what to do with yourself?
Yeah, yeah. So the question is any act of suicide siloed such that it has no ripple effects on society? Or do most deaths rip a hole in the fabric of a community? I think the way you answer that is going to help determine whether you'd be more inclined to say it's okay versus not. I mean, the distinction actually with abortion is that most people don't know she's even pregnant. This is not a life in the world. There's no community surrounding this life. Just like take care of it quietly. But with an assisted suicide, there is a community of people that loss will be palpable, right? There will be an empty chair at the table. And so it's shocking and visible in a different way. Personally, my view is that I don't want to live in a society, and I don't want to raise my kids in a society where we think that life is so disposable that this is how we handle problems of loneliness, problems of social isolation, problems of lack of access to healthcare, problems of not being able to pay your rent. I mean, that is the work that communities should be doing to help members of communities flourish. We shouldn't just kill people, but that's the direction it's going. I don't want to live in a society that's going more and more in that direction. Let me say one more thing. My friends and my colleagues in Canada, I have many colleagues there who originally were kind of like, they're like good liberal progressives, like bodily autonomy, sure, you know, why not MAID? Many of them have stopped performing MAID because they are seeing it's just going out of control. So it used to be that if a patient would say, hey doc, I don't want to go on, you'd sit down with that patient, you'd say, what do you mean, Mr. Smith? What do you mean you don't want to go on? Like, what? Talk to me, what are you feeling? You mean you want to stop your cancer treatments? Are you depressed? Should we talk about that? What does that mean? My friends in Canada say now when a patient says, doc, I don't want to go on, we say, okay, I'll call the MAID team. And the MAID team has an imperative to deliver MAID. That's why they exist. And in medicine, we all know your reason for being has to do with the money you generate for the healthcare system. So there is a perverse incentive to deliver MAID once the MAID team is called, just like you would say, well, if you call palliative care, of course they have an incentive to come and do their consult, et cetera, right? And we bill for that. So, yeah.
Is there a concept of the author of life and the value of suffering and the epic mortal sin that's being committed by everyone involved? Does everyone just dismiss all of that?
Well, I mean, that presumes a very different metaphysic, right?
You don't have to be a Catholic. I mean, just to have kind of concept of, well, I didn't create myself. Maybe something else created me, and maybe I'm accountable to that.
I think that's not part of the conversation. The conversation is, look at this person with this terrible cancer. It is a tragedy she has to suffer. She should be able to die on her own terms. That is the logic. So nothing, there's like, you're not accountable to anyone, you're accountable to you. You do you, right? That's what the kids say. You do you. Yeah, please.
I have a question, or just, I guess, like a clarifier. When you had brought up, like, your friend had a friend who, like, was like a, like, sad that she had cancer, and I don't know, the thing you talked about her, like, doing the suicide.
The tragedy was that she had to die naturally?
So, yeah, and then what was your argument in that? Was that the fact that she didn't die naturally, or the fact that, like...
So it ends up being the complaint is lack of access and not being able to control the timing of death for a patient who is like so close to the end. She actually died a natural death and wasn't suffering.
Yeah.
But it was spun as this is a tragedy because she should have been able to actually kill herself. but she couldn't kill herself. Instead, she died a natural death without pills, but wasn't in pain. I mean, that's the ideal way to die. But it's because now there's a procedure that can make one dead, people think if they don't have access, that that's somehow they're being short shrifted. No, that she didn't get to do it the medicalized way. That's why she was upset.
Okay, because I'm like, I guess like an argument to that, like if that had been like, the case would be that like a lot of the things we do in medicine like aren't natural. Like, right? Like, I think a lot of the things we do in life now are like what is natural? I think we've talked about this in my other class, like what is natural?
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say what's natural, what's not, because we're okay with like injecting people with poisons, like for cancers and stuff like that. And so it's like,
so why not just inject them so they can die on their own terms? I mean, that's exactly. So is there anything that pushes back against that? And I think the argument for the vulnerable is probably the most powerful non-religious argument we have. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, and I take care of a very vulnerable patient population right now, and they feel like they're fighting for life, not for death. And one of the things about, I think ultimately it's the vulnerable who suffer once you make hastening death legal. But right now the people pushing for it are the people with wealth who are used to controlling all aspects of their life, who are very much the 1%. And the downhill of that is that all these people who aren't the 1% are gonna end up feeling like they just have no choice but to end their lives. I'll just say a couple quick things. I've had families come to me, I think I may have alluded to this last night, who have wanted to stop their parents' medication so that their parents die sooner. I have had adult children come to me with their dad with dementia who has a huge estate, lots of money, and they're trying to figure out how we can stack the deck so he dies sooner. This is a problem. I've had adult patients come to me and say, I don't have children, or I have one son and he's highly accomplished and I can never be a burden on him. Will you help me die? So this is not, once you make it legal, all kinds of people are going to hasten their deaths because it's just the easy way out. The tasks of living are hard. They're hard, but we see in enduring through the hardship the beauty and the benefits of endurance, because it fundamentally changes us as human beings. We grow in character. We grow in hope through that. So anyway.
And then people arguing for PAS know it will eventually go to E.
Yes.
It will eventually go to E because you can't stop it at PAS.
No.
Because then you can argue, I'm being prejudiced against. You have to inject it.
That's right.
Excellent job.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.